What's it like living here?
Well, you know, it's like living in a David Attenborough documentary. I guess that's the best way to explain it. You walk out the door and you're amongst seabird colonies. You're just 5 minutes from a coral reef. And the island has this great history of conservation. It is one of the best environmentally managed islands in the world.
Jones and an angry young blackbird caught in a mist net with you on Lord Howe Island. This is Off Track, a program which combines the sounds of nature with the mostly epic stories of Australia's wildlife. I travelled to Lord Howe Island as a guest of the Australian Museum. Lord Howe Island is a territory of New South Wales, and it's a small thing, about 400 kilometres off the coast. It wasn't inhabited by humans until European settlement, but it was inhabited by an astonishing array of plants and invertebrates, and frankly, it's a bird nerd's paradise on this island. People from all over the world come to see the amazing array of seabirds in particular, right up close. Even David Attenborough.
Nobody knows why it happens. But when you make strange noises here, seabirds fall from the sky. I'm on Lord Howe Island, a tiny speck of land 300 miles off the east coast of Australia. Human beings only got here a little over 200 years ago, and it seems that the birds that nest here are still quite curious to see what's going on. And these birds, which are coming to these calls, are Providence petrels.
Now, seabirds, like petrels, you can understand how they might come to find and stay a while on an island like this. But what about a forest bird, like a golden whistler? What about this buff-banded rail and her chicks? Or even the amazing and unique Lord Howe Island woodhen. The history of arrival of birds on Lord Howe Island is a complex affair, and it's not as simple as a blow-in gets a foothold. In the current makeup of island birds is the story of winds and storms, of lonely birds stranded in a foreign rainforest, of human settlement and impact, and of plain old, mostly ill-thought-out introductions. And Richard Major, a bird ecologist with the Australian Museum, has come to the island to study it all as a part of the 190th anniversary celebrations of the museum.
I love islands, and it's an island. It's out in the middle of nowhere, and so it just triggers all these questions about the plants and animals and how they get there. Colonisation, extinction, evolution. So it's very undisturbed. Lots of the work I do is on the effects of urbanisation and agriculture. So this place is a sort of paradise in that regard. It's not an urbanised landscape. It's as pristine as you'll ever get. Although, you know, even here there's been some changes that have affected the species that are colonising the island now.
Imagine a golden whistler. A bird about the size of a sparrow. There's a male, vibrant, yellow, with a black head and a white neck like a formal fronted shirt. And along with a sweet little brownish female, he's building a nest in a patch of bush near Coffs Harbour in New South Wales. And imagine that together they collect twigs and tiny strips of bark and they bring back gobfuls of spiders' webs and bind the cup. And in between times, they dart and flutter and chase insects and eat berries from the forest trees. Until, perhaps, a wind builds to a storm. And, caught in a vulnerable spot or a mistimed flight, a wind too strong to resist, perhaps this golden whistler is blown far, far away from the mainland for hours or days over ocean waves. Until, by chance, a slither of green appears. This rocky outcrop somewhere to land and get over that experience that this little golden whistler has just survived. At least, that's what my imagination says could happen. And surely after all of that, any land, any island, like Lord Howe, would be a bird utopia.
No, probably not, because a lot of them would arrive by themselves and they would be, you know, not do anything, you know, they'd be lonely and they would not get anywhere. Over 200 species, I think, have been recorded on Lord Howe, lots of vagrants, so lots of birds are getting blown or flying, as you say, being seen but never establishing. There must be a lot of chance involved as to getting a couple of birds that are able to breed, then have those get through genetic bottlenecks so they survive, and finding the, you know, right environment here. There must be lots of experiments have happened that have failed, and we've got this, you know, interesting group of animals here that have succeeded. And yet even here in this pristine environment, things have changed a lot with people over the time people have been on the island. We've seen extinctions, we've seen colonisations of new species, and some of those species that are colonising probably have only been successful because humans have changed the environment here, that we've got some pasture land and places that birds can get a foothold, whereas it wouldn't have been a paradise for a purple swamp hen coming straight into a rainforest.
What is needed then to actually effectively colonise? What do you need? You need more than one?
Yes, you need someone to breed with. You need some habitat that will provide your ecological needs. So you've got to have the right food sources, the right nesting sources. So you've got to have a niche, a sort of suitable niche available, which is not occupied by some other animal. If it's already dominated by one species, it'll be much harder. If there's something that's, you know, already filling that niche, if you arrive then if you've got it totally open.
So going back in, you know, geological time, I'm imagining the volcano that formed this sort of little sort of area of islands, and then maybe some of the rock turned to dirt and then a seed blew across.
Yeah.
Sort of is that the sort of thing that we're talking about?
Yeah, and just there's this whole assembly of an ecosystem over a long period of time, and then eventually it gets to the stage where the birds that blow across here have some suitable habitat that they can survive on. Because of that, islands tend to be quite depauperate faunistically. You know, there weren't that many land birds on Lord Howe, you know, even when people first came here. I think there were only 15 species of land bird. Islands are interesting because they are isolated, and starting from small populations, we get that opportunity for species to differentiate from the mainland groups. So we have some endemic subspecies here on the island, the golden whistler, the silver eye, and the currawong. They're all have diverged sufficiently that they're morphologically different from the mainland form. And interesting, there's some general rules about the way birds evolve on islands. You know, there's what we call the island rule. It's really first initiated for mammals, which is small mammals become larger on islands and large mammals become smaller. And the island rule for birds for a long time was rejected, largely because the early studies weren't looking at the whole range of birds. But generally, small birds tend to have larger bills on islands. And one of the hypotheses for the larger bills and small birds becoming larger is because they're depauperate, there's not that many species on islands, there's not so much competition between species, but there's lots of competition within species. And so being larger means you can dominate your conspecifics more, and so that selects for larger size and larger bills and things. I mean, these are some of the questions that we use our museum specimens for, and why we're collecting DNA now in this current trip is because we've now got these, you know, very sophisticated tools for looking at the evolution of animals through DNA, and so we might be able to understand some of these processes better.
And getting DNA samples of birds means catching them. And in this case, in this piece of forest, that means mist nets. Long contraptions so fine that you can barely see them hanging in between the trees. You're likely to catch yourself with one of these things.
So is it vertical now?
No.
Mist nets are they're a very fine mesh. We've got nets that are 18 metres long, and they have five shelves, if you like. So there's five strings along which we have this very fine net suspended, and we put them in a place where the bird can't see them. And when the bird is flying through the forest, it intercepts this net, and its weight then sort of makes a little pocket and it falls into the net, and where it gets stuck until we rescue it.
You're a noisy one.
So we take them out of the net then, catch them, band them, measure them, and take a blood sample. They're tiny. These silver eyes are 12 grams. So they are tiny things in your hand. They are fragile, but they're also surprisingly tough. They can be handled. They're actually a bit more robust than they look. You know, they are dinosaurs. Think of them as big, scary dinosaurs stomping through the jungle. They're actually quite tough animals.
54.3.
54?
Yep.
Richard Major is collecting DNA samples in the hope that scientists might use the information contained within them to elucidate the evolutionary journey of the birds. When they arrived on the island, and where did they come from?
34.4. 119.
The golden whistler found here on Lord Howe Island, it's not quite a species of its own yet, and it's the same with the silver eyes that are here. And I've got lots of photos of these birds over at the Off-Track website. You should go and check them out. abc.net.au/rn/off-track. Go on, take a look. On Off-Track today, we're on Lord Howe Island, a bird watcher's heaven, with lots of birds packed into a small space, and many of them without fear of humans. Some are really unfamiliar, like masked boobies and tropic birds, but there are some of them that I've definitely seen before, like the mudlark, the peewee, or the magpie lark. It's all the same bird. Hank Bauer is a World Heritage and Environment Manager for the Lord Howe Island Board.
So it's thought that they were brought in by the board to control insect pests. With the arrival of rats, we lost a lot of insect-eating birds, and particularly we lost a silver eye, a large silver eye called the robust silver eye, which had a large beak, and it was thought that it controlled a lot of insects that attacked palm seed. So the board brought in blackbirds, European blackbirds, and they brought in peewees, mudlarks, hoping that they would control those insects. But the blackbirds are ground forager and the peewee is a pasture forager, so they weren't really the best species to target insect pests of palm seed.
So it was an attempt at biological control in some form, really, and but that particular one was a little bit misguided.
Totally unfounded. It was like early days when someone thought it'd be a good idea to bring a cane toad to deal with cane beetles, but cane toads don't climb cane where the cane beetles occur. So it's a similar situation as that.
Yeah.
We've learnt from those mistakes, luckily.
Earlier on, we introduced a lot of birds from Europe to Australia. Some of the reason for that was that the settlers were disappointed with the sounds that Australian birds made. They were a bit too raucous, and so we needed some beautiful songbirds like blackbirds around the place. But some of the other introductions were, like the masked owl was introduced, and that was to try and eradicate the rats that had been introduced. So different purposes, people bring different animals.
Does the masked owl still persist on the island?
Yeah, so it's the boobook owl was a native owl on the island, which became extinct relatively recently. The masked owl was introduced to control rats and mice. It has also some negative impacts on some of the petrels, though, too. So the masked owl, I don't think anyone would say was a particularly good introduction.
The board, back in the day, very early on, obviously a very significant rat problem. They looked at options to help control, and they brought in barn owls and masked owls from various zoos, and they even brought in American horned owls. That's it. So they brought all these owls in here, but the masked owl established, and it's doing very well. Its home territories here are very relaxed compared to how they operate on the mainland. And they do control rats. We've done a lot of work on the masked owls. They do predate on rats and mice. They do a good job there, but they also attack seabirds. So the white terns, the black-winged petrels, all those seabirds are heavily impacted by the masked owls. We find areas where they snip birds' wings off. They catch, say, a white tern, and they'll take it to a favoured site, and you can find piles of wings.
Did you listen to the previous episode of Off Track, where we heard all about the potential rat eradication on the island? Well, if the rat eradication program goes ahead, these introduced masked owls will also have to be removed from the island because, you see, without rats to eat, it's likely that they'll predate even more heavily on other birds, perhaps birds like the endemic, not found anywhere else in the world, rare as anything, Lord Howe Island woodhen. But it's a really interesting thing, this argument about what is native and what isn't, because the white terns that Hank Bauer was just talking about that have their wings ripped off by the owls, the how and the why that they managed to colonise the island is sort of a complicated story.
The white tern is an angelic little bird which nests on a horizontal branch, just places its egg on this branch, and doesn't construct a nest. They are pure white with a blue bill, and everyone loves them. They're beautiful birds to look at. The white tern is thought it arrived in the 50s. So the white tern is actually quite common on a lot of tropical Pacific islands, including Norfolk Island, and it was never here on Lord Howe. The Lord Howe early settlers planted a lot of Norfolk Island pines, so it's thought that some birds from Norfolk were fishing around here and thought, oh, those trees look all right. They got lots of nice horizontal branches. We might use them to nest on.
Okay, so this is really interesting, right? Because how do you manage this biodiversity? Because you've got insects, land snails, amazing biodiversity that's been here forever, and then you've got a lot of biodiversity that has either self-colonised or has only colonised because of human interaction. How do you actually make a decision of what to protect?
Yeah, well, the white tern's an interesting one because it's the only nesting colony in New South Wales territory. So it's listed as a threatened species. And so is the Lord Howe Currawong, which predates on white tern chicks. So it is an interesting dilemma. Well, it's nature. Currawongs do eat birds, and it's their island as much as the white tern's island. Nicholas Carlisle from National Parks has done research here on the seabirds, and he's recorded an increase in white terns over the years, just slightly, but that tells us that the white terns can live with a certain amount of predation. So we just let nature take its course. That said, if a white tern chick falls out of a tree and it's on the ground, someone will pick it up, climb, put a ladder up and put it back up there. And there are people who, if they get orphaned, people will take them and feed them and then they'll fly away. And there's been one instance of a resident who reared an orphaned white tern chick, and he went up to Middleton Reef, Elizabeth Reef, sorry, for a fishing trip. And this tern came and landed on him, and it was the same bird that he reared, recognised him, and that's, you know, hundreds of kilometres away from Lord Howe Island out in the middle of the ocean. The natural predator on the island is the currawong. Our currawong is endemic, and it's a very interesting bird in itself. It actually dive bombs like magpies during the nesting season. It's very inquisitive. It'll follow you around the bush. You can actually break off little sticks and throw them at them, and they'll catch them. And the other day I was out doing rare plant surveys, and I had a tape measure out, and the currawong grabbed the end of the tape measure and dragged it out to the end of the bush, which was really helpful for me because I got to measure the width of the bush.
How are the currawongs different? You said that they swoop, which is something you probably don't associate mainland currawongs with doing. How else are they different from the mainland ones?
They've got a thicker beak. They've got a more orange eye. And their demeanour is they just act differently. Currawongs on the mainland, you know, generally fly around high in the trees, and these guys, they'll hop around the ground. They right down the mid-story, they really dig through logs. Anyone who's been here and who has interacted with them will notice their difference.
Yeah, and they also have a different song.
Oh, they got obviously they've got a very different song.
Yeah.
But currawongs around Australia have all got different dialects, which is I find that fascinating.
Every single bird species found on Lord Howe Island is a product of such peculiar history of happen chance strung along one after the other. The right wind, the right clearing, the right mate already here to greet you. 8 Lord Howe Island endemic bird species have gone extinct since the arrival of humans on the island. But some birds have also arrived since then and added to the cacophony. Like the kestrel. It's a small bird of prey, and it was self-introduced. And that means...
It was flying around and saw Lord Howe and thought, this looks fabulous. So I don't think they would have been here prior to settlement because they like open country. So prior to settlement, the island was all forested. They might have passed through and they might have stayed here for a while and hunted along the cliffs, I don't know. But from my knowledge, they weren't recorded here at settlement.
And so that's interesting. It's an interesting sort of happen chance of history, isn't it? Not only did that bird get blown or fly within this area, but if the human settlement hadn't have altered the landscape in the manner it did, it might not have been able to get a hold and a breeding hold, as in actually, you know, have viable young on the island. It's such a weaving path of history.
Yeah, so it's another bird which probably falls into that category is the buff-banded rail. There were early records of them here, but they like open swamps, and Lord Howe prior to settlement would have been very, very thickly forested, and the area of swamp would have been very limited. But now we've got lots of pasture and there's lots of rails.
And seriously, I've never got close to rails in the open like I have on Lord Howe, where this adult lead chick's right underneath my feet. Too close for the focal length of my lens. That's how close it was. It was incredible. Of course, there's another ground-dwelling bird that has to get a special mention in any program about Lord Howe Island, the woodhen.
That's the creme de creme. Yeah, the woodhen, almost extinct. And the community got together with National Parks and the broader Australian community. I remember as a child buying stickers to save the woodhen, and I thought, gee, that'd be cool to be involved with woodhens one day. And lucky me, here I am now. So the woodhen was predated by cats and pigs, so both those animals were eradicated by the residents. And there was a captive breeding program brought in place, and the residents really, really supported it. And from then on, we do an annual census, so every year we get out for 2 weeks and we try and band as many woodhens as we can. So we keep track of the population, make sure they're going well, and the community really interact with them really well. They all know who their birds are because they all got bands. Something's going wrong with them, they'll ring us up and say, oh, so-and-so's got a sore foot, can you go and check him out? They're a fascinating bird. Again, not scared of people. They walk around your yard and they're pretty easy to catch. Well, most of them are. Some of them can be a bit challenging, make us look quite stupid. But yeah, great personality.
And as evening falls on Lord Howe Island and the sun falls directly into the ocean, then there's a shearwater flying in to feed its young in a burrow, and it almost takes your head off. It sounds like this. That's Lord Howe Island, full of birds with personality. And wind off the ocean. And palm trees rustling all the time. And shearwater chicks getting a feed. This is Off Track. And remember to head over to the website and check out the photos of the birds and the island. And also to get in touch if you'd like to record some of the bird song at your place or leave a message for me about your own adventures on Lord Howe Island. I'd love to hear it. All the details are on the website, don't be a stranger, abc.net.au/rn/off-track. I'm Anne Jones, the host of Off Track, and I'll be here kitted up for a new adventure next time, when I'll take you somewhere else.